Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Do you ever think of all the food that is available in Wisconsin's woods and waters, fields and streams, from panfish to berries, from wild turkey to deer? We will go on the hunt for wild foods this hour with the author of Wild Rice Goose and Other Dishes from the Upper Midwest. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, June 25th. We will welcome your questions and your favorite ways to prepare and eat the foods that we can hunt, fish, or forage for, or even buy at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is John Motoviloff. He is a hunter, fisher, forager, and writer. He's out in the field over 100 days a year. He is the author of Wild Rice Goose and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest. His other books include Wisconsin Wild Foods and Fly Fisher's Guide to Wisconsin and Iowa. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
You live in Wisconsin, too, is that right?
I do. I kind of live in two places. Spend most of our time here in Madison, but we also have a cabin in the Kickapoo Valley, which is a prime foraging territory. So, I'm lucky enough to spend my time in two sorts of places.
Tell us how you came about to loving hunting and fishing and foraging for your own food.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, really, I did some of that as a kid growing up on the East Coast, but, you know, space and resources were limited, and I came out here for graduate school in about 1990, and it was just kind of like a kid in a candy store, you know. Everything was available, tons of public land, and that kind of kicked off a long love affair with wild foods. And I guess in the mid 90s, my wife and I actually took some modest savings that we had and bought this cabin in the Kickapoo Valley, and that definitely just kicked it up a notch, because there, you know, I'm able to walk out the door and pick blackberries or go squirrel hunting, or we're right on the Kickapoo, so go and fish for northern pike, all within walking distance. So, I should mention, too, that really right here in town, there are some good foraging opportunities. I mean, I've found morel mushrooms here in town in Madison, and then, you know, really any railroad track, along any railroad track, you're going to find, decent, very crops of blackberries and black raspberries, and even occasionally some wild asparagus. So I shouldn't say I just do it there. I do it in town as well, and fish the Madison Lakes too. So
yeah, you don't have to. It doesn't have to be in the Wisconsin Northwoods. It can be right here in an urban area.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, with the exception of hunting, the lakes here are a great resource, and really just little woodlots in town. Here it is coming up on cherry season, and a number of neighbors will let me pick their pie cherries, which for some reason they don't want to eat, but too bad for them, good for me.
Seriously? I mean, are these wild cherries?
Well, I guess technically they're not wild. There's one sort of tree, cultivated tree, that's in a yard, and then there's another. We've got an alley back here, and there are a bunch of them that have seeded themselves back here. So I guess they're not technically wild trees, but they're like, they've established themselves. And I've got carte blanche, so lots of pie cherries coming up on the menu here.
Oh, that'd be great. You know, it's not a wild tree either. I planted it. A tribute to my father who loved them, a serviceberry or a juneberry tree, and I just harvested a handful of juneberries yesterday.
Yes, indeed. And then I should say, too, that mulberries on the horizon very, very, very soon. I mean, I think they're just starting to get some color, and they're definitely a good urban foraging opportunity.
Yeah, and I know that the strawberry season is upon us, and there are wild strawberries too.
There are, Joy, definitely, and they, for some reason, they're very temperamental little fruits. They tend to come on maybe about at this latitude, right around Memorial Day, maybe a little bit after, and then they last as long as we have that nice cool June weather, which wasn't very long this year. But they're super sweet, and they tend to grow along, you know, forest paths or disturbed areas, actually hiking trails in state parks or state forests or another place that people could find them. But yes, they're absolutely are wild strawberries, and they don't keep super well, but boy, are they sweet and flavorful. I mean, they grow in pretty good quantities near our cabin, and so what we'll do is we'll, you know, just pick a handful before breakfast and, you know, put them on some yogurt or put them in pancakes or something. But they're not the kind of thing where, you know, you can go pick a flat of them, you
right.
know.
Right.
And keep them. So, yeah, there's actually so much to talk about.
So you are out in the field or on the water a lot, over 100 days a year. I'm not sure you're going to do that today, but if you were, what would what's for dinner?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think I'm not backpedaling, though, but what I mean by that is I don't necessarily spend 100 full days in the field. But what usually I do is I'll get up, you know, before I begin work, and you know, maybe I would go out and fish Lake Wabisa for a couple of hours for bluegills, you know, or maybe in the evening I'd go and pick some blackberries. I guess mulberries or strawberries. So yeah, I definitely do that, and I kind of mix it in with my workflow. But what would be for dinner if I could go out today?
Mm-hmm.
I would say fried panfish and some kind of cobbler for dessert. Now we could mix in rhubarb and strawberry. We could do possibly rhubarb and cherry. You know, so yeah, fried fish and cobbler, I would say,
yeah.
would be on the menu.
So how do you like your bluegill? I mean, in terms, isn't there a recipe? Some famous Kathy's fried bluegill is
yeah.
in the
Boy,
book.
You've done your homework. yeah, and I'm so glad you asked about that. There are a number of ways that I cook it, but I think that when it comes down to it, just fillets of bluegill. You know, neatly and quickly kind of deep fried, that would be my favorite. I can get to some other ways after that, but the thing that's distinctive about Kathy's bluegill, it's actually it's the mom of some pals of mine, and they have a cottage up north, and we always wondered, why is Kathy's bluegill so good? And what I learned in watching her is she'll sit there with if she's got one of those, you know, large fryers, she'll use those, or she'll sometimes do it on the stovetop, but she really, really controls just how many fillets go into the oil at
mm-hmm.
one time. So oftentimes, you know, people are in a hurry and they'll throw a bunch of fillets in, and that doesn't work too well because the more fillets that are in the oil, the cooler the oil gets, and obviously the cooler the oil gets, the you know, the worse the breading will stick. So she'll put, you know, maybe five or six in at a time and then flip them and take them out and drain them on paper towels. And so I think her secret there is technique. You know, it's all about just getting a couple of fillets in at a time and then sort of backing up here, making sure that they're really dry before you put the breading of choice on them. So that is definitely an excellent way to cook bluegill, you know, and then make a little bit of homemade tartar sauce, chop up some pickles and mayonnaise, and put that on the side, and maybe some fried potatoes, and you're in business. But I've also cooked bluegills as a part of like a fish chowder, you know. So let's say, you know, instead of getting a limit of bluegills, I maybe would get five or six or something. So I'd scale them out, clean, you know, and gut them, and then sort of gently boil them and make like a stock or a bouillon. Take the fillets out, separate the meat from the bones, and then kind of make a roux on the bottom of the pan, saute my onions and potatoes and maybe carrots, add some of the fish liquor back in, replace the fish, you know, that's off the bone,
mm-hmm.
and then stir in some cream at the end, and then you've got a beautiful chowder.
Does that sound good?
What I like to stress in the book is that you don't ever know what the hunters or anglers are going to really bring home, and so it's great to be able to have, you know, 8-10 fillets apiece, but if it doesn't go that way, you know, a plan B could be making a chowder.
Sounds really good. We will continue talking about other things that sound really good that we can harvest in Wisconsin's Northwoods or in our own backyards, the Upper Midwest, a wild food haven where you can forage and fish and hunt for your meal. We are talking with the author of Wild Rice, Goose, and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest, and you can too. Do you have a favorite wild food or way to prepare it that you'd like to share or a question for our guest? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with John Motoviloff, who is the author of Wild Rice, Goose, and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest. We welcome your questions for him. Are you like him? Do you like to go out and hunt and fish and forage and prepare the ultimate in local foods? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And we have a lot of callers, and we will get to them. But I'm wondering, John, what was the motivation for Wild Rice, Goose, and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've had a sort of a long-standing connection with UW Press, and I was in there actually pitching an entirely different book and got talking with the acquisitions editor, and he looked at a previous cookbook of mine and thought, well, would you be interested in doing an expanded version? So we got talking, and I realized that, you know, I love to cook. I love to go out and forage and fish and hunt, and It didn't take much, you know, brainstorming to kind of get this idea percolating here. So, I mean, to some extent, the immediate, you know, the initial inspiration for this was a conversation I had with Raphael Kadushin over at the Press. But I guess sort of backgrounding that is, you know, my kind of love affair with woods and waters, you know, and also in the kitchen, you know. So, yeah, all of those things kind of came together, perfect storm, and here we've got this beautiful book sitting here.
Yeah, I was wondering, too, with the real push for local foods these days, this is the ultimate local food, isn't it?
You know, it really is, and it's funny. I think people are getting around to seeing that, yeah, I mean, the in terms of local food, this is really the pinnacle of it, because you're getting rid of the middleman, you know, and you're going out and doing it yourself, often spending less, you know, gas than going to the grocery store and less money. So there's a whole economic angle to it too. But yeah, it absolutely is local food, and you know, as I was just kind of getting at before, you know, the person does not have to go very far to do this. You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot right in town, whole lot just outlying, and then of course the rest of the state.
Yeah. And not everybody's a, you know, a hunter or a fisher. We can all forage, certainly, but you also have in the book a growing number of businesses that will sell these local foods.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned that too, because that was another thing that came to us when we were writing the book. I mean, I was vaguely aware that there were a few, but gosh, I just began scratching the surface. And for instance, right out near the Kettle Moraine is Rushing Waters Trout Farm, fantastic supplier, and they actually have fishing right on the premises too, but you can buy their product, their trout, and their trout spread right here in Madison. There's another place actually in southeast Wisconsin, McFarland Pheasant Farm. Again, you know, fantastic resource. And both of these places you can either, you can order, you know, just by sitting at your computer and calling, you know, calling on the telephone and get your wild foods delivered to the right to your door. But no, there's a whole lot that's available. And there's an entire appendix in the book where you can look and see what you're interested in and order it. And most of the time, those orders can be placed, you know, at your computer or via telephone. There's a growing. I mean, I think these folks see how good it is, and they're business people, you know.
Yeah. Let's take a couple of calls. Caitlin in La Crosse is with us. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to share, I was delighted to hear this topic on my drive to Madison this morning, but my husband and I live in the upper Mississippi River Valley on the western side of the state in La Crosse, and it is an absolute haven for fishing, hunting, and outdoor foraging. I just wanted to quickly share a couple of go-to recipes that we have for fishing and hunting. My husband is a big fisherman, not only on the Mississippi, but on Lake Onalaska, also some of the inland trout streams. We constantly have sunfish, bluegill, crappie, and perch in our freezer and in our fridge. And I heard the speaker talking about the, you know, go-to fried bluegill, which I completely agree with a little bit of shore lunch is fantastic. But something that we love to do is actually eat just boiled bluegill. We just toss it in a big pot of water, boil it, and have it with a little bit of butter and Dijon mustard on the side, just a smidge, not too much. It'll go far, and it is absolutely divine. I was surprised the first time we had it, but it's a go-to for us now. And we also like to throw it in tortillas and make some fish tacos, which is also great with the boiled bluegill. Very, very good. And then just one other, we a lot for venison, but he's also a duck hunter. And we love to make a good duck gumbo. I feel like duck can be a little tough sometimes. And myself, I've struggled to find something to make with the duck. To really, you know, bring out that flavor, but really please a crowd that may not necessarily have a taste for wild game. And throwing that duck gumbo in, you know, making a roux, throwing some vegetables in there with it, and a little bit of bacon and sausage, whatever's around. I've also found that that's an excellent dish and go-to for us.
So, Caitlin, thank you so much. Those are wonderful tips. Maybe briefly, I wish I would have thought of this. My mom used to boil bluegill, and I thought she was kind of wacky, but it sounds good that way, John.
It's funny. And hearing Caitlin there, it was just, there's so much that I could relate to in her call. My cabin is not terrifically far from La Crosse, and I spend a whole lot of time on the upper Mississippi and those trout streams, so way you know into that same territory. And yes, boiled bluegill. I've seen it also served. You boil it briefly and you chill it and serve it almost as like a shrimp cocktail. You know, so I think that would be another way to go. And her recipe for gumbo, I mean, completely. I've got one in the book, and I think we're very. I mean, it's funny. It's sort of parallel evolution. I mean, I know exactly what she's talking about with duck. Duck can be a bit tough, you know, and so a gumbo is perfect.
Yeah, well, we probably let's talk a little bit more about, I guess, about the game birds, since we've talked a lot about fish so far. Maybe. Well, I don't know. Maybe we should talk about the star of the title, wild rice goose.
Absolutely. You know, wild geese are, you know, they get a little bit of a bad rap because there are large populations. populations, resident populations of Canada geese, and people see them, you know, in town and on golf courses, and they've become something of an urban nuisance, maybe in the same way that that venison, you know, that mm-hmm. city deer can be. But if people sort of abstract it from that and realize what, you know, that there's still a huge migratory push of geese that come through, and that these geese, you know, local or migrant, just can make terrific eating, as long as a person knows what to do with them. And they're a very, very, very distinctive flavor, which kind of lies between, in taste, between a, fowl and almost like a red meat, almost like a beef or a pork. There's a real kind of, heartiness to them. And it, just as Caitlin from La Crosse, you know, said, the challenge in cooking any game bird, or really just about any game, is keeping it moist. And so a gumbo is an absolutely terrific way to do it. I think, getting back to sort of the title and the title recipe, another way to handle game birds like ducks and geese in the oven is to cook them at a really low temperature. And by that, I don't mean, you sometimes see a cool oven as 325, but I have cooked them as low as 200, 225, 250, and that's where I really get the tender birds, because they have so little fat. Mm-hmm. A domestic goose has got a lot of fat, but a wild goose has got very little. So the title recipe calls for, you know, lightly stuffing the goose with onions and a little bit of loose sausage and wild rice, and then pinning some sausage strips to the breast and cooking it, you know, in a covered roasting pan. I think I don't exactly have it open, but it's somewhere around 250, and it will produce a really, really tender bird.
We need to, I need to jump in, because we have news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio coming up next, and then we will continue talking about all of the wild foods that we can enjoy here in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. We are talking with the author of Wild Rice, Goose, and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your questions about finding and preparing wild foods at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are learning that the Upper Midwest is a wild food haven where you can hunt or fish or forage for many of your meals, and you can even buy these wild foods at a growing number of businesses. Our guest is John Motovilov, hunter, fisher, forager, writer. He is the author of Wild Rice, Goose, and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest. His other books include Wisconsin Wild Foods and Fly Fisher's Guide to Wisconsin and Iowa. We were talking before the news break, John, about the star dish of the title, Wild Rice Goose. Talk some about preparing that goose. I'd also like to talk about the wild rice. Where do we get wild rice, and how do we prepare that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's funny you ask that, because just during the break I was sitting here and thinking, okay, well, we covered what's happening right now, what wave we're on in terms of, food. So we got panfish and berries. Kind of the next wave, if you will, happens in late summer and early fall. And there we've got, you know, nuts, hickory nuts, walnuts, and some mushrooms, and, of course, wild rice. Now, just like the other, ingredients in the book, wild rice can either be, you know, foraged or purchased. So purchasing is a little simpler.
Yeah.
And they're really, you know, most of the major grocery stores in town carry it. The Willie Street Co-op, I know, carries it, as does Whole Foods. Before I get into the harvesting part, one distinction, there is commercially grown wild rice, which is grown in paddies in both upper Midwest and in California. And then there's sort of the real kind of wild item. Now, I don't necessarily knock the commercial stuff. It's a lot cheaper. It still tastes good. But there's a sort of a much more local kind of artisan, organic, if you will, quality to the stuff, you know, found and harvested in the wild. And that you need to look is going to be more expensive, and you need to, you know, look and make sure that it's sort of, you know, it'll say, you know, Canadian Lakes wild harvested rice. You know, or there are a number of tribal vendors who will sell that, especially along Lake Superior. And you know, I know that a lot of the native people up there have special rights to harvesting. So it makes sense that they would sell it. They're not the only vendors of it, but that stuff, if a person can get it, it's, you know, it tends to be hand parched, you know, harvested from wild growing stands. And there's more complex, maybe nuttier flavor to it. But do be prepared to pay, say, if you'd pay $2-3 a pound for the, you know, for the commercial stuff, you'd be paying $5 or $10 a pound for the real wild rice.
Yeah, you're in the book. You say that wild rice is associated with the Upper Midwest. Is it unique to this region?
Well, it likes, you know, shallow, slow moving waterways, you know, that occur above the 45th parallel, and that tends to really occur in wooded areas. And so while there's a little bit out east, you know, say, you know, maybe upper New York State, Maine, and some of the lake, northern New England lakes and riverways, really the kind of the heart of wild rice country is the upper Midwest and southern Canada, you know, the country that starts in the northern parts of Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and then, you know, kind of goes up into Ontario and Manitoba. It stretches out. You find a little bit of it out in North Dakota, but really mainly we're in the heart of wild rice country.
Yeah, and we will get into some of the other wild foods that are coming into season soon. But we have a question from Ken in Waukesha.
Yeah.
Are there classes where we can learn about foraging for wild food? I would love to do this kind of stuff, but I don't know how.
Well, I know that the Wisconsin DNR is starting a kind of a mentorship program for new hunters, and part of this is going to be, you know, I think that the course culminates in how to prepare your catch, particularly probably fish and game. So I know that that's one program, and I don't know exactly where to link to it on the DNR site, but I know that that's a program that is either underway or is going to be underway. That's something on my to-do list is to you know, give some classes in this. I cannot point to an exact schedule right now. I have done and do events around the state where I talk, so I wish I had a more tangible, concrete answer for Ken, but it, you know, these things do, they do happen occasionally. I just don't have a date handy. But well, I think checking the DNR website would be a good start.
That's good. And if we see something on the DNR website or other things about classes related to this, we can put them on our Facebook page as well. Well, I was just going to go to a call from John in Richland Center, who wanted to say that he likes trout fresh out of the stream. They taste like candy. So do you think so? I mean, because they're fresh out of the stream?
I couldn't agree more. And this is coming off of a good buddy of mine, Jason Stein from the Journal Sentinel, and I went out to my cabin and fished some of the streams out in Crawford and Vernon County. And his dad was along and his son. And we had we kept a few for the table. And yes, they are wonderful and underrated. And oftentimes, I think people are a little bit hesitant to keep, you know, to keep trout for, I don't know, maybe because they're so special or so beautiful. But if a person stays, you know, within the harvest limits and maybe doesn't do that every day of the year, you know, these streams are very, they're very fertile, and the trout populations overall are very good. So there should be really no hesitancy as far as, you know, affecting the population. And they do taste like candy. I was going to say they taste a little bit, there's sort of like the taste, they taste like the sweet water that they come from. You know, those streams are so fertile and so cool. And yes, there's, I could for sure think of them as fish candy or candy. And in fact, we did one batch just simply pan fried, and another we made up a homemade teriyaki sauce and grilled them. And they are, They're extra special. The one thing that I would say too is if you get a trout that, you know, sometimes the trout have been, the older trout tend to feed more on crustaceans, and that gives their flesh a pinkish kind of color. And if you're lucky enough to get one of those, then you're really in for a treat. The white fleshed fish aren't bad at all, but when you get one, when you open it up and you see that the flesh is red, then you know you're really, really in for good eating.
We are talking about all of the good eating that is available in Wisconsin woods and streams, Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. Our guest is the author of Wild Rice Goose and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest, talking about all the foods that we can find if we hunt or fish or forage. And we wonder if you do any of this. Do you like to forage or hunt or fish for your food? What are some of your favorites? What are your some of your favorite ways to prepare wild foods? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with John Motoviloff. He is a hunter, a fisher, a forager, and an author. He is the author of several books, including his latest, Wild Rice Goose and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest. And he's telling us how we can find or forage for or harvest everything from our Wisconsin woods and waters and how to prepare those foods. And we're welcoming your questions for him, and we're welcoming some of your favorite. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, we didn't get into maybe the next round of yummies from our from our outdoors. Nuts and hickory nuts are coming up in July, did you say?
I would put those a little bit later, probably maybe you can start harvesting walnuts probably in the early part of August, and then I think hickory nuts probably in, you know, September and October. So, you know, I mean, that's, you know, so I would say blackberries and blackberries, sort of early apples, and then you know, and then nuts. And my goodness, I mean, that is an absolutely overlooked, especially hickory nuts, just a really overlooked resource.
Yeah, those are, I remember harvesting hickory nuts from, you know, the parks as a kid.
No, they're, it's funny, on my, just right down the street here on Winnebago Street in east side of Madison, there's a beautiful hickory tree, and the nuts fall on the ground, and no one seems to gather them except me. But yes, they absolutely are in the parks. There is, I don't know how to do this other than by taste, but there's a shag bark hickory tree, which has, as the name implies, shaggy bark, and then there's a what's called a pignut hickory, and there's another folk name for it. The pignut hickory is not, it's not poisonous by any means. It just doesn't taste very good. It has a bitter sort of taste. So, and I think the bark is not quite as fringed. But really, the only, if your hickory nuts taste bitter, I guess they're going to probably be the pignut version. But the shag barks are, I mean, you're going to spend a lot of time getting the shell off. But but boy, are they good.
Well, you know, we've talked about, we've got lots of calls now too, but I didn't want to end the hour without talking about a big area of wild food that you spend quite a bit of time on starting off the book, and that's the big game. And maybe you can just talk about, maybe a favorite dish that that you have involving big game.
Sure. I mean, when we talk about big game in the upper Midwest, I should just sort of define it because it could mean different mm-hmm. things in other parts of the country. We don't have, mostly here, we're talking about deer, venison, but also there are limited opportunities for moose hunting in Minnesota, and a small elk season in of all places in Michigan, and then as well as some bear. I think most of the time here, deer is the thing. And absolutely, I mean, I have two favorite sorts of things to do with venison. I really, really, really enjoy a nice rare venison steak cooked over charcoal. And I have a simple go-to marinade, and that's just you marinate the meat in two parts Worcestershire sauce to one part peanut oil with a good, healthy dose of that crushed, black, just freshly ground pepper and a little bit of sea salt, and, maybe let it steep in the marinade for, you don't need more than an hour. I mean, you could do it up to maybe 4 hours. And then the key there would be cooking it, You do not want to cook it beyond medium because it's just not going to taste. It's going to taste kind of livery. But if you get it, if you nail it somewhere between rare and kind of medium rare, it's just about fine, lean, organic beef. It's just absolutely fantastic stuff.
And then there's lots of small game, obviously, in the upper Midwest. Is that something? I'm not a hunter, but I can. Yeah. Can I hunt rabbits and squirrels right now?
Could if you were a landowner, and I don't think that there's even necessarily a limit to the number of the season. Okay, so let's say you are a landowner. I think you mm-hmm. can pretty much hunt them year round. Everyone else, the season runs for rabbits and squirrels. September squirrel season opens September, usually the middle part of September, and then is a long season. It runs into the end of January. And rabbit, I think, starts a month in the south. It starts a month later, starts in middle October, and then runs to the end of February. So they're very, very long seasons, and very generous bag limits. I think most people have better culinary associations with rabbit than with squirrel, mm-hmm. but I would easily put squirrel on par with rabbit. It's just a really wonderful, tender, kind of rosy pink meat, and the flavor is they taste like what they eat, which is to say wild nuts, a little bit of grain, but they're really fantastic resource. But yes, so here we are almost July, so I mean, we're only talking 2 months till the hunting season gets going.
All right, let's see. We have lots of calls, so let's go to Jeanette in Marquette. Go ahead, Jeanette.
Hi, good morning. Yes, squirrels are delicious. But just something to let folks know, as a Park Service employee and a biologist, that to also always know where you're collecting, that you've spoken with the landowners. In the case of the National Park Service, you can have berries, but you're not allowed to collect mushrooms or hunt or anything like that. And one of the good reasons to know your landowners is permission, and also to make sure that some of the plants you've been collecting haven't been sprayed if somebody's spraying for invasive species. So that's a really good thing to do. And as far as looking for foraging tips, there are, I can't think of the one name right now on the internet that is a foraging group, but there's also Survivor Man Les Shroud has a good book about some things like that. And I think there's Bo, it's something with bringing women in the outdoors with Wisconsin DNR.
Yeah, it's UW Stevens Point, I think, too, yeah.
Yeah, and those would be some good places to look as well. Tom Brown Jr.'s books, The Tracker, he speaks about some of the foraging. And there are a number of other good books about foraging as well.
Thank you very much, Jeanette, for the call. And good advice, certainly, to make sure you ask permission before you start foraging on someone's land.
Yeah, that's terrific advice, and I neglected to mention that. I think it's just so ingrained in what I do that I wasn't thinking of the public service aspect. But, yes, super important. It's important for so many reasons. I mean, it's important because it's the law, and it's important because it's the right thing to do. It's also important because, you know, you can find out about spraying, but you can also landowners can just be an absolutely terrific source of information, either for the thing you're looking for. They can say, oh, well, you know, no, just go over the fence row, and that's where all the rabbits or grouse are, or about other things, you know, that you might be talking about picking blackberries, and then the conversation will go along, yeah, and I have this pheasant population here, or you know, squirrels, or you know, there's a pond with bluegills on it, or what have you. But you know, and you know, I it's just it's the right way to do it, and it also really results in oftentimes in better outcomes. So she's certainly right about that.
Thanks, Jeanette. Tom in Waukon, Iowa, is with us. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share with your guest in the audience herring, fresh same-day herring out of Lake Superior. You can get it at any usually the fish shops around the lake. Actually better than trout. Pan-fried with garlic, butter, whatever you like. Just absolutely delicious.
Herring out of Lake Superior, John.
Yes. You know, and it's funny, one of the mentioned Rushing Waters earlier as a trout farm. There's a whole tier of commercial fishermen, actually along the Mississippi River, interestingly enough, though they're not getting herring. They're more out for carp and catfish. And then along Superior, yes, herring is an absolute delicacy. And there's a place that comes to mind called the Angry Trout Cafe in Grand Marais, Minnesota. And it's a restaurant, and they sell a ton of lake herring, and it's fantastic stuff. I mean, it comes from really cold water, and it's got all those good oils in it. And I neglected to mention that, but they're delicious.
Thank you, Tom. One more, Beverly in Montello. We're almost out of time, Beverly, but what do you like?
Well, I grew up in Pennsylvania on a farm, and every spring my dad would go out and dig sassafras roots to make sassafras tea. I can't find it here in the Midwest.
Hmm. Is that around the upper Midwest?
You know, Joy, I'm not aware of it. If it is, it sounds to me it's something that I associate with kind of the Middle Atlantic and further south. I'm not aware of it growing here, but I do know folks will make a lemonade out of staghorn sumac berries, you know, and kind of use that as a concentrate powder and make lemonade out of that. But I'm not aware of sassafras growing here in the upper Midwest. My gut sort of tells me that they were a little too cold, a little too far north for that.
But there's plenty of other things to make, teas or lemonades or whatever else.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go. What would you like listeners to remember about this conversation?
Well, it's kind of obvious, but one thing I mentioned is that this book is available through the UW Press, and they've got an 800 number. That's 800-621-2736, or on the web at www.uwuniversitywisconsinpress.com.
Yes, and we do have that information on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for being with us.
You bet.
John Motel-Beloff is a hunter, fisher, forager, writer, author of Wild Rice, Goose, and Other Dishes of the Upper Midwest. Thanks to Robin Cherry and to Cynthia Schuster for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.